All right. This is a really, really good topic. Hopefully you guys can tell everyone about it. They can listen to it online if they're not here. So Rav Yonasan Eibschitz, who is famous for a lot of things, but most famous for being despised by one of his congregants, Rav Yaakov Emden. What does that mean? So we'll start with a little bit story of his life, and then we'll do with some of what the controversy was built around.
Are these Yekis, by the way? Are you sure?
They are not Yekis. They are from Altoona, Hamburg, and Wandsbek. So they're right in between. They're in Moravia, in the area right between, I guess, Germany and Poland. I guess they were Yekis for Galiciana, they'd be Yekis.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know, for a Yeki they'd be Yeki, but certainly for a Litvak or for a Galiciana, they would definitely be Yekis. Okay, so who is Rav Yonasan Eibschitz? So he is born in the area of Moravia. His father dies at a very young age, but nonetheless he is marked early on as an Eloi. In those days, they were very good at picking out who was going to be your superstar at a very very young age. And if you were one of the superstars that were picked out at a young age, it meant that they were going to make sure that you got the proper education to take advantage of your superstardom and to see to it that you become a major Talmid Chacham. So he is sent around. Remember, the center of Torah study in those days is in Poland. He's sent around to the major academies of Poland and Moravia, and ultimately emerges as one of the great Talmidei Chachamim. The other way you can tell that someone was a superstar in those days by who they married, because you would get to marry the daughter of a Talmid Chacham if you yourself had superstardom qualities. So the fact that Rav Yonasan Eibschitz marries the daughter of Rav Yitzhak Shpira, who's the Av Beis Din of Bunzlau, that is in itself saying much about his abilities. In 1715, he settles in Prague, where he becomes the Rosh Yeshiva, and he gains not just kind of sort of prominence, but immense prominence as a preacher. The days before television, so your best entertainment, right, was making sure you had someone who was a great preacher. People would come from far and wide to hear the great lectures and the great homiletics of Rav Yonasan Eibschitz. During that time in Prague, so Prague is this great cosmopolitan city, so he fosters strong relationships with non-Jewish intelligentsia. These days were, I guess, relatively good for Jews in the Middle Kingdom, you know, not necessarily in Poland and Lithuania, and not necessarily in Germany, but certainly for people living in the Moravian Kingdom, what I'll call the Middle Kingdom for lack of a better way of describing it. So things were fairly good for them. So he has an opportunity to become involved in this kind of interchange of philosophy and education and discussion. And he fosters also, we know, many debates on religious matters with Cardinal Hasselbauer, who was the leading cardinal in Prague at the time. And so this is a bold move. Here you have really someone who's coming up as a superstar in terms of his religious qualities. And during that time, he gains permission to publish a Talmud, which excludes the parts which contradict Christianity. As you can imagine, this was quite controversial at the time, and he was criticized particularly by Dayan David Oppenheimer, who was a major figure in Western Europe at the time, for this decision, and also for his general desire to be involved in kind of these cosmopolitan discussions in general. But he does become really one of the great Jewish apologists of his time in the conversations that he had. In 1725, and this is an important piece of information, that's why I put it on the list, he joined with Prague's rabbis to excommunicate all Sabbateans. If you remember, Shabtai Tzvi was this false messiah who came to prominence at the end of the 17th century. Even after he converted to Islam and even after he died, people continued to maintain the belief that he might have been a Sabbatean, that he might have been the Messiah. And therefore, there were these kind of closet, hidden, clandestine groups of people who continued to believe that Shabtai Tzvi was the Messiah. Okay, and as we saw when we discussed the Chacham Tzvi, Rav Tzvi Ashkenazi, who also had a very similar type of experiences to Rav Yonatan Eibeshitz, which again, that's going to be interesting also. But one of the things that we saw is that there were many amongst the rabbis who felt it was their responsibility to root out and to find and to hunt down all of these Sabbateans, lest they become a cancer on the Jewish people of the 18th century. Out them, excommunicate them, separate them from the community, declare their philosophies unacceptable, etc., etc.
So they are the Hasidim of the Shabtai Tzvi.
Yes, they're the followers of Shabtai Tzvi. In 1736, he takes over as the Dayan, as the chief rabbinical court judge in Prague. Again, a very, very distinguished position. We're talking about here about an individual who is on his way to becoming one of the Gedolei Olam, one of the great men of his generation. In 1741, he is named Rabbi of Metz. Metz was a significant Jewish community. And also, during this time, he also gains the reputation as being a great Baal Shem. What does that mean? He's a mystic and a Kabbalist. What does that mean also? It means that people come to him for Kameyas. For those of you who remember, there's a Mishnah in the 5th or 6th Perek of Shabbos, which talks about whether one may wear a Kameya when walking out in the street on Shabbos in a place where there is no Erev, right? That's one of the Mishnah's questions that it's dealing with. Why is that important? So they go to, because what would they use Kameyas for? Kameyas were used for people who needed to be healed. They would go to the Baal Shem, and the Baal Shem would write a special Kameya for them that they would wear or they would carry with them in the hopes that it would call down spiritual powers in order to heal them. And this is one of, he gains a reputation, aside from being this great scholar and this great speaker and this amazing all-around rabbi, he also is known as a great Baal Shem. And in 1748, he basically hits the jackpot. What is the jackpot? He is named rabbi of the three main communities of Moravia, what's called Kilot Ahu. What does Ahu stand for? Altoona, Hamburg, and Wandsbek. He becomes rabbi of these communities, and by all indications, he is very, very much beloved by the people of his kihila, and he's well respected, and he's known as a posek. He continues to serve as a Baal Shem, where people will come to him and ask him for these kameyas. Also moving to Ahu during these times is one of the community's favorite sons, Rav Yaakov Emden. Rav Yaakov Emden is born in Emden to one of the former rabbis of Kilo Tahu, the Chacham Tzvi Ratzvi Ashkenazi. That's why Rav Yaakov Emden, many of his works are known by the terminology Ya'avetz, Yud Ayin Bet Tzadi, Yaakov Emden Ben Tzvi. That's what it stands for. So Rav Yaakov Emden petitions when he moves back to Ahu. He's living a private life. That being said, even though he's living a private life, there's indication that he believes that he is the rightful heir to the rabbinate of Altoona, Hamburg, and Wandsbek, being that his father was the rabbi, and his father was also, if you remember from when I discussed it, was kicked out over the kashrus of a chicken. That was the issue that that caused his father to lose his position, the position he took over the kashrus of a chicken. But Rav Yaakov Emden comes back and he petitions the religious authorities for the right to open up his own minyan in his house. And this is perhaps the greatest mistake that they ever made in the history. Never agree to a breakaway shul, right? That's the old philosophy. They say, fine, you are permitted to have, and there were very particular rules that were set up for Rav Yaakov Emden's minyan. He was only allowed to have a certain amount of people in his minyan, etc., etc., etc. And ultimately, this is what happened. Rav Yaakov Emden sets up his own minyan, okay? He does not like Rav Yonasan Eibershitz, we said, for obvious reasons. Already, there were rumors from when he was started out as a Baal Shem, as there would be probably about any mystic, since Shabtai Tzvi's philosophy was based very much in Lurianic Kabbalah, in the Kabbalah of the Ari. Since Shabtai Tzvi's Kabbalah was based in that, there were already indications, you know, kind of implications, you know, people discussed under their breath over whether some of Rav Yonasan Eibershitz's opinions might have been somewhat controversial. So what happens? One day, a kameya written by Rav Yonasan Eibershitz is in 1751 is brought before Rav Yaakov Emden. Rav Yaakov Emden researches this kameya, and he declares publicly in his minyan that Rav Yonasan Eibershitz is a follower of Shabtai Tzvi. That's what he says, and that was his conclusion. This creates one of the greatest upheavals in the history of European Jewry. Rabbis from across Europe weigh in on this issue, all the way in Western Europe, from Rav Yecheskel Landau, Landis, the Noda Behuda, the Vilna Gaon. You have everybody weighing in on this issue. Polish and Lithuanian rabbis tended to support Eibershitz, while German and Western European rabbis tended to support Rav Yaakov Emden. And this was an all-out war, if you can imagine. What made it even worse was Rav Yaakov Emden had the great privilege of owning his own printing press, which is basically the equivalent of a BlackBerry in those days. Why? Because what makes, or an iPhone, or however you want to do it. Used to be that if you're going to send someone a letter, you had to sit down and you had to think about it and you had to, you know, write everything out and then, you know, then you would mail it. And if you were going to send someone a nasty letter, so, you know, you had enough time to think about it before you wrote something nasty to someone else. Now what happens? It doesn't work like that anymore, right? Because what happens, you know, if you're angry at someone, you know, instantaneously you pull the phone out of your pocket and you send them a nasty email now. So if you own your own printing press, you don't have the time to take it over to the editor. The editor has time to think about it, etc. So Rav Yaakov Emden is publishing like crazy these anti-Eibershitz papers and pamphlets, etc., etc. Okay, ultimately, what was it that caused Rav Yaakov Emden to, or what was it that ended it? The king of Denmark had to intervene on behalf of Eibershitz because the community as a whole was supportive of their rabbi. He intervenes on Eibershitz's behalf, but the controversy always remained, even though Eibershitz's job was secure, at least for the time being, at least until he passed away later on in 1764. But that was the end of his life. So I just wanted to give you, that's kind of the background. And one of the fascinating questions is what caused a scholar like Rav Yaakov Emden to believe that Rav Yonasan Eibershitz was actually a Sabbatian? Was he correct or was he not correct? And this is hotly debated by scholars. But one of the blessings that we have, and you can turn over the sheet and you can see it, is that because Rav Yaakov Emden owns his own printing press, he was insistent that he would, what? He was going to meticulously record how he came to the conclusion that Rav Yonah ben Ibishitz was in fact a Sabbatian. So in front of you here, I have two kameos from that were written by Rav Yonah ben Ibishitz. Not only that, but there, I believe Dr. Lyman, Dr. Schneer Zalman Lyman, who's one of the experts in this on this field. So I believe he has an article where they actually have notarized copies of these, just because they knew there would be debate over whether or not they were authentic or not. So they got notarized. Okay, Rav Yaakov Emden wrote a book called Sfat Emet V'Lashon Zahorit, basically the speech of truth and the mouth of gold or the tongue of purple, whatever it is. Okay, but the point is he's going to be saying he's going to be proving that Rav Yonah ben Ibishitz is in fact a Sabbatian from these documents. So let's start with number one here. So you can look at this here, and you don't have to be a Hebrew genius to know that every one of these words here on this first kameya are completely meaningless, right? What does it say here? B'mam yatzpatz akaka akahe Yisrael. Ah, hashochein. All right. So what's going on here? So here you have to know two coded Kabbalistic writings. What are the two coded Kabbalistic writings that Rav Yaakov Emden figured out or claimed that was actually written here? So he says that it's actually hidden behind this is At Bash and Al Bam. And you can see I put them both down here. At Bash, what it does is it has the alphabet forwards and backwards. So you have Aleph, Bet, Gimel, Dalet, Hey, Vav, Zayin, Chet, Tet, Yud, etc., all the way. And then you have Tet, Shin, Resh, Kuf, Tzadi, Pei, etc. And if you put them one against each other, so the Aleph becomes a Tuf, the Bet becomes a Shin, the Gimel becomes a Resh, the Dalet becomes a Kuf, and so on. So let's look at the word B'mem, right? The first word there, right? Bet, Mem, Mem. So Mem, if you look on your on your Al-Bam list, right, that's the second one, excuse me, I forgot the second one, I messed it up just, the Al-Bam, so it has Aleph through Chaf on one, and then Lamed to Taf on the bottom, and then the Aleph is exchanged for the Lamed, the Bet for the Mem, etc. Okay, so those are the two things there. Okay, so let's start. B'shem, that would be, so he claimed the first word was actually B'shem in the name of Yud Tzadi Pei Tzadi. So what is Yud Tzadi Pei Tzadi? So Yud, he claims, is Yud. What is Tzadi against? So Tzadi from the back of the alphabet is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. What's the fifth letter of the alphabet? Hey. So what? So he says, let's replace the two tzadis for hey. So then you have yud hey, pei hey. But what is pei? Pei is the tenth letter from the back of the alphabet, which means it corresponds to. Oh, sorry. Excuse me. It's the sixth letter from the back of the alphabet, which means it corresponds to what? Vav, right? Which means yud tzadi pei tzadi is actually what? Hashem's name. So what's the first words? B'shem Hashem. The Chaf, what's that interchange for? Alamed. B'shem Hashem, Elokei Yisrael, Hashochein, that's a normal word, we all know what that word is. Be'o Eret, but here, if you're a Kabbalist, you know exactly what that's talking about. What's it talking about? Tiferet. What's Tiferet? Tiferet is the center of the world of the Sefirot, right? So the name of God, which what? The God of Israel, which dwells in the center of the spherotic realm, which is Tiferet, Uzo, Elokei, next word, Kacha Olamim, Chaf and Lamed are interchangeable, Kol Olamim, etc., etc., and then you get to the words Bilib Hay says, what's it called? Says Rav Yaakov Emdim, what does Bilib Hay mean? Shabtai Tzvi. Why? Bilib, so he says, the bet is shin and not bash. The yud is shin in albam, the second one. The lamed is an aleph in albam. Okay? And then what do you have? A shin again, shabtai tzvi. And then you have hey yud yud. So what is he saying? Hey is tzadi and not bash. Okay? And then you have again tzvi. So he claims the word bilib hey is shabtai tzvi. That's what he says. Okay, in the next one, it's a little bit clearer. Okay? You can see I circled it here in the next one. Mivichaf. Right? So mem. Right? Mem. The bet is corresponding to what? To a shin and not bash. So mem shin yud chet. The pay is a vav. What does that say? Mishicho. His Messiah. Right? And what's the word? The word is Shatmi Havai. And he claims that refers to Hey and Sadi are correspond to one another, right? Sadi is the fifth letter from the back, so it's Hey and Sadi. Shabtai Tzvi. Mishicho, his Messiah, Shabtai Tzvi. And he goes through a number of the Kameyas and all of them, and it's total sensible reading once he decodes them using the Atbash Albam decoder. Once he decodes them, they all look perfectly fine. So what is ultimately, I'll read you here how Rav Yaakov Emdin reads the second one. So he says, how do you read, not that one, the first one, I'll read it for you. B'shem Hashem Elokei Yisrael Hashulchein B'tiferet Uzo, in the name of God, right, the God of Israel, who dwells in Tiferet Uzo, Elokei Kol HaOlamim, I just finished the second line, right, the God of all of the worlds, okay, so he says, Ne'latzim Nivraim Yitzurim, right, where Ne'latzim means to emanate, where emanates from him all creations, and other types of creations. Asuyim, another word for creations. Hasomech noflim, right? Who, what does somech means? Who props up those who fall, right? Uveshem shchinat kodesho, and in the name of his presence, his holy presence. Uveschut mishicho, and in the privilege of his Messiah. Hold on, excuse me. Uvizchut mishicho, ha'emet, the true, right? Hey aleph yud yud is hay aleph yud is ha'emet, and then he says shabtai tzvi hakadosh, right? The holy shabtai tzvi, ani gozer, I declare or I make a decree, al kol shedin virochim umazikin shelo yaziku b'shum nezer. I make a decree that all the terrible demons shouldn't cause any damage. And he goes through almost every one of them, and almost every kameya has some sort of reference or hidden reference to Shabtai Tzvi, which he's able to pull out using the Atbash Albam system. Okay, so Rav Yaakov Emdin says, I got it. Proof positive, Rav Yonasan Ibishitz is a Sabbatian. So here's the problem with what Rav Yonasan Ibishitz does, is he keeps on changing his story. First he says, you're wrong, you're misreading it. Then he says, this is what I learned from my teacher. Then he says they're forgeries. So he keeps on changing his story, and that kind of leads everyone to believe, or at least it helps Rav Yaakov Emdin gain more followers, because he's saying, look, I have proof positive. this kind of hounded and dogged Rav Yonasan Eibeshitz so much that ultimately he actually wrote a response to all of this. It's called the Luchos Eidos. The Luchos Eidos is Rav Yonasan Eibeshitz's response. It's long, so I didn't photocopy it all of you. I think once you saw the Kameas, you know. The truth is, one night I spent like going through the Kameas to see if I could figure out what they said myself, because it's not consistent in always using the same code, right? It'll go from Atbash to Albam and then back to Atbash, and sometimes it won't use anything, and you have to try to figure out what the actual code is per letter, and then you can try to create it. But you see, like the word Bilib Hay continuously means Shabtai Tzvi, or it seems to mean the name of some sort of Messiah, which might be Shabtai Tzvi. So this is what Rav Yonasan Eibeshitz says. You can hear in his own words. Vayomer Yehonasan. So he says. So Yehonasan says, this is what Rav Yonasan Eibeshitz says. Ru'u ki chashku einai haro'im baruvot vayadu shomeni beit ulpana. Says, I'm all depressed now because of this. He says, because people are making false accusations against me. And he says, but I'm thankful. He says, He says, I know many people are suffering with me. So he says, in this whole thing, he says, I feel like I have no choice but to respond to those who are out, he says, to get me with these false accusations. And he claims all of these are false accusations, that none of them were intended to be Shabtai Tzvi, and they're finding things that don't really exist. That's his claim the entire time. So, you know, I leave it up to, you know, your capable minds, whether you want to decide whether Rav Yonasan Eibeshitz was a Sabbatian or not. But I will tell you this, regardless of whether he was or he wasn't, he had this massive influence upon his congregation. He really very capably led Kilo Sahu. And he also has had a major influence upon the history of our religious experience. Why? So a number of his works are very important. Number one is he wrote a work on Yoredeya, particularly focusing on the laws of Kashrus, but almost everything. And also he has stuff on Nida and other areas. He wrote a commentary on the Shulchan Aruch called the Kresi Uflesi on the works of Yoredeya, and they're very important. He also wrote an Urim V'Tumim where he deals with issues, with monetary issues. That's also on Choshen Mishpat, and a collection of his drashos, one on the Parsha called Tiferes Yonasan. One on the Haftorah called Tiferes Yonasan, and the other on the Parsha called the Avas Yonasan. We said that he was known for his homiletical abilities. He also, apparently he wrote a number of works of Kabbalah, but even though he wrote a number of works of Kabbalah, none of them were ever published except for one called the Shem Olam, which if you're looking for circumstantial evidence that he may have been a closet Sabbatian, which is, well, maybe his mystical works were not published because, you know, they had some sort of Sabbatian type of leanings in them. That being said, working in favor of Rav Yonasan Eibeshitz is, there were a number of false claims made against Rav Yonasan Eibeshitz as well. So for all the true claims against him, you saw here the Kameas could definitely be read as referring to Shabtai Tzvi. That being said, there were a number of false claims against him also, you know, claiming that there were tombstones that had secret, you know, Shabtai Tzvi. So a lot of these things turned out to be false. So because of that, that had it working in his favor. Working against him was that his son actually came out as a Sabbatian, which again, you know, as I pointed out to someone, I think one of Rav Shach's sons was a Zionist. It doesn't make Roshach a Zionist, you know. So I don't want to say, you know, we shouldn't judge people. You know, plenty of people have had children that have gone off the derech, but it doesn't say, you know what it is about them. So I don't want to make any assumptions because of that. But just so you know that debate is out there over status. That being said, I thought it was worthwhile considering the influence that he had. You know, everyone, every time they learn any Eibishitz, you learn Emden Eibishitz, Emden Eibishitz. But the truth is, he had a lot to say. So I figured I'd give you, just to go home with, a little Dvar Torah on the Parsha that he gave, on Parsha Shlach, where he asks the question. He says, listen, granted hindsight is 20/20, but everybody knew, he says, it seems like all the Midrashim seem to indicate that everybody knew something bad was going to happen with the sending of the spies. Right? It just, Moshe changes Hoshea's name to Yoshua, knowing that there's a potential for bad. And not only that, but the mistake was compounded, he notes, but that what? Yoshua sent spies again. Like maybe Yoshua should have said, maybe we should choose a whole different perspective here. And he offers four answers, and you can see kind of the eclectic nature of his scholarship here. So answer number one is that he says Moshe felt like he had to send, after Parshas Baaloscha, Moshe felt like he had to send spies. Why? He says the reason anyone sends spies is because you plan on doing something in a natural way, right? If you were planning on doing something in a supernatural way, then you wouldn't need to send spies, right? HaKadosh Baruch Hu is your spy. He knows what's ahead of you. You know, go. But Moshe, after the sins of Bnei Israel, he saw that the Jewish people had sinned, and therefore he felt that we had that if we were going to conquer the land of Israel, it wasn't going to happen because you have to earn supernatural investment by God, right? In order for God to actually invest in your life in a supernatural way, you have to earn it. He felt that the people had come so far that they had sinned, that they hadn't earned it in a supernatural way. It's actually interesting. He also goes on to explain Yehoshua's spies. Where do Yehoshua's spies stay? Yehoshua's spies stay where? At the home of Rachav, who's an Isha Zonah. She's a prostitute. Why are they staying at the home of the prostitutes? So Rav Yonasan Eibishit says, he says, listen, he says, listen, Yehoshua knew that sin was going to prevent them from having supernatural intervention by God. So what does he do? The spies go to a place where they could sin, and they don't sin, right? What was the last sin of Israel, right, on the border of the Jordan River? The sin of Baal Peor, where they slept with Midianite women, right? So what do? They had the opportunity, and they chose not to. So they did tshuva, hopefully, or earning God's supernatural intervention. And what ultimately happens? The walls of Jericho fall down supernaturally. So that was number one. Number two is, he says, his second answer, he says, is that Moshe and Yehoshua weren't stupid, and neither were the Canaanites. The Canaanites, what were they thinking? They were thinking, we're dead. God's going to fight for them, and we're all going to lose, because how are we going to be able to defeat the Canaanites how are we going to defeat the Israelites if God is fighting them? So what does he do? He sends spies to make the Canaanites think that God is not fighting for them, that they're going to fight themselves, and therefore the Canaanites are going to come out and fight them, you know, hand to hand, thinking that they can beat them. And therefore, you know, he's tricked the Canaanites ultimately into fighting. That's his answer number two. Number three is, Moshe recognized that ultimately the goal of the Jewish people was to make everyone believe in God. So he said, maybe if I send Meraglim first, I'll have a chance to save the Canaanites from potential destruction. Maybe I'll be able to be Megayer them, you know, I'll convert them. And he says, what's his proof? His proof is, Chazal say that what ultimately happened with Rachav, this prostitute woman that Yehoshua's spies went to, she was ultimately Megayer. So you see, spies have this power to be Megayer. And number four is he was checking on, and this is a little bit more of a Kabbalistic, I think this one went a little bit over my head, but he was checking, he says, the sar, the what's it called, the special demon or angel in charge of the Canaanite nations, he was checking to see if he was still there, or whether the land had kicked them out, and whether they would be fighting a war totally in the realm of the heavens, or they would be fighting a war on earth. So that's just a little bit of his homiletics there. You can hear like why he would be interesting. He's interweaving a lot of different themes together. And so Rav Yonatan Eibeshitz, for whether he was a closet Sabbatian or not, at that point, I don't know if there was any nafka mina to being a Sabbatian at that point. Shabtai Tzvi was dead. He believed, I don't know, that, I mean, how many people believe that that the Rebbe is going to come back to life? I mean, listen, I don't know, you know what I mean? I don't claim to know what he believes. I do know that in terms of the Crazy Uflacy and in terms of his commentaries on Chumash, he certainly had a very profound influence upon the Jewish people. And again, just a little bit of his background there.